Millions of people are waiting for the total solar eclipse to begin. The moon will move between the sun and the earth on Monday. It'll block out sunlight and create a shadow that'll move from coast to coast across the U.S. for the first time in 99 years.
This is a cosmic coincidence, and here we are to witness something like that in your own backyard.
This is going to be a heck of an event for us.
How do we wrap our brains around what is actually happening here?
Literally, you will go from daytime to nighttime. You can see stars in the sky.
And so right now, you've got a lot of people who are wondering what's going to happen here.
It's going to be great.
What a week.
One big event between now and then that we got to be very careful about. And that's Bonnie Tyler singing Total Eclipse of the Heart during the eclipse. Because if you don't think the end of the world, that could be the sign the end of the world's actually happening.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it was a negative week for the stock market. Most of the major indexes pulling back across. The only thing that had a positive return this week was the utility index and also bonds. Bond rates dipped lower and utilities headed higher. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in hour one, Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray will be joining me. And he's indicating that what we're seeing now, this pullback, is like a pressure making diamonds, basically getting ready for the final run up to the end of the year. Craig remains very bullish. He is forecasting we hit 2575 on the S&P by year-end close. We're about 2430 right now, so that's a big jump. He's very positive, and he also thinks the one area that could outshine just like it did last year, the one nobody's watching, is energy. He'll be joining me along with Frank Holmes as we talk about the gold market. Gold is bucking up against 1300 again. You want to hear why Frank thinks we finally bust through 1300 and where you want to be positioned when it comes to commodities. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. If you've been listening to the program for the past few months, you know we believe that we are in the late stages of a business cycle, and the probability of a rollover into a recession in the near future is most definitely not out of the question. It's a probability. You're well aware that the Fed has been behind all recessions and bear markets. So having said all of that, what are the factors which are harbingers of trouble spots ahead of this rollover, notably auto loans, student loans, and large corporate debt? And when the storm does come, how does it all unfold? What does it look like afterwards? And what should you be doing ahead of time to prevent yourself from being damaged by the storm? And even if you can, to profit from it? That will be the main topic of the big picture today. All of that coming up on the Financial Sense News Hour. But first, Ryan Poplava is back on deck to tell us what's going on in the markets. Two major down days, Ryan, within six trading days. It seems like you were right to talk about seasonality last week when we did, with August quickly becoming known as a very volatile trading month. And last week, it was fears over North Korea and Trump escalating their verbal salvos at each other. Was Thursday's sell-off a result of all the hoopla over, you know, we've had all of this stuff about Charlottesville or the Barcelona terrorist attack? Did it have any effect on that?
Well, it's definitely, when we talk about these terrorist attacks, it is really dependent. The market has a way of looking at how localized are these situations, as tragic as they are. Does it really affect the economy? And if it doesn't really, we're not going to see a huge change in the market. Obviously, we did with the World Trade buildings taken out. But, you know, seasonality, John, is definitely what's at play right now over the last 2 weeks. Like you said, two down days within six trading days. It feels like a lot, but really we haven't had any kind of 3-5% correction in a very long time. We've been spoiled, right? So now that the market's showing us that it does have the ability to go in both directions, that, you know, it can be a little scary. But, you know, I think that there were a number of reasons together that formed the weakness this week. And we know that the market has been vulnerable towards a pullback. And we've been talking about it. I talked about it last week, that other indices weren't following the Dow higher, the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That being, you know, look at the Russell 2000. The Russell 2000 topped. That's a small cap index that topped on July 25th. And has been in a corrective mode since. And that was about the same time as the NASDAQ. The peak in the Dow Jones transports was on July 14th. And I talked about that a few weeks ago, where the transports weren't really following the industrial average. And that's something in technical analysis that we watch very closely. It's called Dow theory. When they're not following each other, you go with whatever the previous signal was. And the previous signal was both of them rising to new highs. So we're still in a bullish mode, but it's not as bullish. The transports are not following those industrial average stocks higher. But the initial sell-off on Thursday last week did some technical damage, and this week's as well, cutting through the 50-day moving average. It's done it twice. And when it happened on Thursday, it was like a hot knife through butter. It sat right above that 50-day moving average for maybe, I think, an hour, and then it cut right through it. So definitely some technical damage has been done, and that's part of the problem. And we are nearing some short-term support levels, like I talked about last week, 2400 for the S&P 500. That was a level we had a hard time getting above in the spring. You know, after the March, we rallied all the way up into March, then we went through this sideways correction, which we call a correction in time, not price. And right now, are we going to get the same thing? Who knows? No two corrections are alike. And we'll just have to see. But there are definitely some areas of support below us. And we started selling off from the get-go on Thursday morning, John. It was really through what I think was based on some of the earnings concerns that we started hearing before the market opened. Cisco and Walmart were some very big reporters. Cisco reported lower revenues, and Walmart, their profit margins narrowed, even though both of them had other beats. That's what the market was focusing in on. Revenues for Cisco and profit margins for Walmart. Then there's NetApp. NetApp cut sales guidance. And so the futures were down right from the get-go with the market opening. The market rallied. It couldn't quite break out to new all-time highs through that rally. And whenever that happens, we get this, what we call a failure swing in technical analysis. And that starts, you know, when you get a lower high, that's this beginning of a possible reversal. But the terror attack, you know, in Barcelona, it obviously didn't help situations for the market trying to have a steady week here and rally from last week's weakness. But as I said, tragic as it was, it really, I wouldn't say, was the source of the correction this week.
It seems like, you know, if we look at President Trump's cabinet, the disbandment of the Economic Council, could that have played into the weakness as well? I mean, when you consider the market was up in the first half of the year with high hopes in healthcare reform, tax care reform, and infrastructure spending, maybe there's just some ongoing fatigue setting in and a level of premium that may begin seeping out of the market. What do you think?
I think that actually explains more of the weakness really than anything else I'm looking at besides the technicals, because I think you're definitely right. And I think you're definitely onto something. I think the market is starting to get a little uneasy with things. Also, you got to look at, we've got the debt ceiling limit that has to be reconciled pretty soon here when Congress comes back from vacation. But yeah, you're right. 8 out of 11 business leaders have left Trump's CEO economic councils, and they left, 8 of the 11 left this week. And most of them were citing Trump's comments in response to the violence in Charlottesville, Virginia. Very underwhelming for a lot of them. Republicans, CEOs, and the media all have said his reaction was insufficient. So on Wednesday, Trump tweeted, and this is his words, "Rather than putting pressure on the business people of the Manufacturing Council and Strategy and Policy Forum, I am ending both. Thank you all." So definitely some uneasiness. That happened on Wednesday, so right before the correction and the weakness we saw all day long on Thursday. But regarding Trump's administration, there were some rumors intraday that Gary Cohn, his chief economic advisor and maybe the next FOMC chairman, was considering leaving the administration. But you know, I won't get into a lot of gossip here. It was a rumor, and it did affect trading intraday. We saw a huge blip in treasury yields, but the rumors did have an immediate effect on trading. So what did happen was, actually on Friday, chief strategist Steve Bannon was being removed, as Trump does what he can to kind of distance himself from this whole situation the whole last 2 weeks, trying to do a little bit of damage control. Bannon has been very well known as having a very protectionist ideology and a very populist view. So maybe Trump is trying to say, okay, I think we've done enough on that side of things. Let's try to be a little bit more moderate. And I would say Bannon's recent comments about China being the main threat, not North Korea, as well as, I think really, if you look at one of his most recent interviews he's done, I forget where the place is. I can't really point you in the right direction, but a lot of articles pointed this out that I read this week, that he did this interview, and in the interview, he disparaged, I read a little bit of it myself, quite a bit actually, that he disparaged his White House colleagues, and he made some really negative comments about the administrative's policies. And that, I think, has set the stage for his exit. That was, I think, that interview was August 11th. But all in all, CNBC is calling this a win for Gary Cohn, who was a former Goldman Sachs executive. Cohn is viewed as a very business-friendly and mainstream advocate for Wall Street, so less of a right-wing kind of a protectionist thought process and style, even though that was very popular. That's what got Trump into office. The market itself is a lot more interested in a more moderate approach right now, obviously. But who might be instrumental in these important issues? The investors really think that's Gary Cohn, who could really set the stage towards tax reform and infrastructure spending. That helped actually stoke a rally on Friday. It got us into positive territory, but we did in fact close negative. So all in all, I think it seems we may be shifting modes here. Sell the rally may be the strategy in the short term. We see until at least we see some technical conditions get oversold and sentiment is lowered. You know, obviously we've had huge positioning. I was looking at a survey by Bank of America recently, by Hartnett, I think. He was talking about the main factors everyone feels towards the market is that the NASDAQ has too much crowding there. And that's been 4 weeks straight. So that's definitely where we're seeing the weakness. The NASDAQ peaked a few weeks ago. And, you know, looking at, are we there yet at conditions are oversold where sentiment is bearish? No, we're not. That's usually when you see about less than 30% of the S&P 500 trading above its 50-day moving average, and we closed Friday at 39%. So we're getting there, not quite.
Yeah, I was watching this whole thing with the Economic Council. I've never quite understood the logic in politics, for having covered it for 50 years, for people saying, well, I didn't agree with what you said about this, so I'm resigning from the council. Well, if you resign, you can no longer have any input.
Influence.
You know? Yeah. I mean, that's sort of what democracy is all supposed to be about. I used to work for a CEO of a corporation, and I would always refer to myself as his most loyal opposition, because I'd always tell him when I thought he was off base, you know, and he couldn't do what he was doing and say, nope, you don't want to go that way, even when it was against the wind. But he always knew I had the best interest of the institution at heart. So I never quite understood that. But anyway, it's the way politics runs nowadays. Everybody seems to be more into statements than substance. But it does appear we've been overdue for a correction for some time. And it makes sense if there isn't a cohesive strategy, say, and a majority to move the ball down the field towards tax reform, infrastructure spending, and health care reform, that President Trump just might be losing support from investors in the market. Let's face it, Ryan, it's been floating on euphoria since the elections. It was a fun high, but maybe we're coming back to reality now, you know. You know, I can remember when you talked about a PE ratio that was probably 1 point higher on Trump optimism back in the first quarter. Any hope you think out there for some of the policies that the president wants to support?
Well, I think this step towards getting rid of Bannon, and I think the support that's likely going to build behind Gary Cohn, former Goldman Sachs executive, yes, I do think there is hope that the market can get, or investors can get, some of the things they're hoping for, which, as you said, the tax reform. Infrastructure spending, I actually never thought that that would happen this year. I thought it was healthcare, then tax reform, then infrastructure spending, I think in that order. So obviously it's taken a very long time on healthcare. Have we gotten anywhere on it? No. So we'll just have to see. A lot of the political thoughts are that tax reform will be a lot easier subject to work out, but gosh, because I think a lot of people can get behind, hey, let's repatriate all the funds that are overseas because nobody wants to bring it over and get double taxed or get taxed at such a high rate. I think a lot of, you know, both sides of the aisle want to see that money come back here, go towards factories, jobs, etc. But if you remember what I mentioned back in the first quarter, the Ways and Means Committee said it will have to be a budget neutral tax reform bill. And that's where things obviously get sticky. You know, where are you going to cut? for that benefit over here. But definitely it's clear. Trump has some damage control to do here from this week and from last week, and he's doing that. Clearly, that's what happened on Friday. How he navigates it from here will definitely affect some trading. Obviously, it's the headlines that are moving the markets right now. But besides Washington and the bad earnings announcements on Thursdays, on a whole, this is what I've been talking about for the last few weeks, the picture is still very bullish long-term. Economic reports that came in this week were mostly good. I think we get a lot of housing data next week, and that's been a strong area as well. But look at the Empire Manufacturing Survey data that was up huge this week. Those surveys, that's towards August data. Philly Fed was okay. The monthly leading economic indicators were released on Thursday from the conference board, and I think our staff, our FS staff, will be updating an article recently on that, so definitely have your eye out for that article. It's one of the key factors we use here at our firm to follow the market, to follow the expansion and decline of the economy. And the LAIs were up 0.3% in July, down from June's 0.6. Most of it, I think, when I looked at it, was mainly due to building permits, which weren't as strong as last month, which was a really big month in June. But Moody's takeaway, I was reading their analysis, is that the expansion should remain solid through the third quarter. Employment has been steady. I think it's averaging around, I think, 180,000 a month, which is well above the 100,000 line that we're looking at that needs to happen for growth. And the housing market is doing well. Home ownership is up, rising home sales, and also there's price growth, which has been continuing. We'll get more on that next week. But all in all, John, conditions are good. So we are looking at this recent correction in light of that, anticipating a small dip. Our technicians have all kind of said the same thing, roughly looking at 3 to 4% dip, calling this a buying opportunity. So that's merely what we're doing. Looking at this as merely positioning and sentiment rebalancing.
Yeah, and on the big picture today, Jim Poplav and I are going to be talking about the oncoming recession, which isn't here yet, by the way. We're talking 2018, 2019, but what it's going to look like, what you can do in the markets right now. And of course, that's what we're doing here from week to week. What does it look like and where are we headed? So I appreciate your input again, Ryan Poplava.
Oh, very welcome. Well, I'll talk to you next week.
I'm Jim Poplava. With the stock market at record levels and the Fed raising interest rates, join me and my staff of experts at my upcoming Wealth Preservation Seminar, which will be held in San Diego on October 21st. We're going to cover the economy, the possibility of a recession and bear market, and what signs to look for that this economic market cycle is coming to an end. More importantly, strategies you can use to protect yourself and your family. Make your reservations today, as there will be limited seating for this special event. Call 888-486-3939 to make your reservations today. Once again, that is 888-486-3939. Call now.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Our asset allocation products certainly are getting a little bit more defensive, and not necessarily, again, because we see imminent recession or a turning business cycle or anything like that on the at least the immediate horizon, but more so because valuations are more than price for positive news, basically. And so when we think about equities, you know, we're a little bit more underweight on the U.S., a little bit closer to neutral internationally. When we think about interest rates in general, this may seem a little bit counterintuitive in this world, but we actually like having some exposure to U.S. interest rates.
Well, the stock market is having a negative week. Most of the major indexes outside utilities are on the negative side this week. Is something serious happening here, or is this a minor pullback? Joining us on the program from Piper Jaffray is Craig Johnson. Craig, let's begin with the major markets. If we take a look at the S&P, we've pulled back now. We're just very close to hitting 2,500. And then also you have on the Dow seems to be holding up a little bit stronger, but we have some deterioration in the transport. So let's begin from the top. What do you see when you look at these charts?
Thanks, Jim, for having me back on the show. Let's talk charts and let's talk about the big picture. When we put out our piece this week. We titled it Pressure Makes Diamonds. And what we mean by this is that in some of the most intense situations, you tend to see a pretty good outcome come to play. You know, this just kind of reminds me of my son playing baseball earlier this year. It was for the championship game for the state. He was the last batter up. There were two outs, and it was up to him to get that final run to score. He rallied to the cause and won the game for the team. So pressure makes diamonds, and I think what you're seeing in this market is something similar. We're seeing these pullbacks in here. They don't look that dissimilar to what we have seen back in May. They don't look dissimilar to what we've seen back in March. We've seen these pullbacks. There's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of pressure for people wondering, is this it? Is this market going to roll over? We're going to get that big correction that a lot of people have been looking for. And I think, Jim, the bottom line answer for me is this, at this point in time, looks like another just kind of pullback, a dip that we want to be buying. We haven't really done that much damage to the overall major trend of the indices. We pulled back a little bit. We've fallen back below our 50-day moving average. We've done that before over the last couple of years, only to find our footing. Bottom line is, there's really good footing at about 2,400 on the S&P 500. And if we do pull back that far, I think that's going to prove to be a pretty decent entry point for people to once again be buying stocks. Talking about in terms of the Dow or some of the other averages, there's a little more damage that's been done on small mid-cap stocks with the Russell 2000 having been a little bit weaker year-to-date and getting hit a little bit harder over the last couple of weeks. But for us, I think right now the lack of strategy that seems to be coming out of Washington at this point in time is probably pushing out any sort of tax cuts that may ultimately get put through. I think people are looking for some of those tax cuts to really be a potential catalyst for small mid-cap stocks, and hence why I think they are lagging in the market a little bit right now.
Craig, let me stop you there because, you know, after Trump got elected, he said three things he was going to do: repeal Obamacare, tax cuts, both at the corporate level, individual level, third, infrastructure. He's been unable to do any of those three. Does that bother you to any degree?
It definitely bothers me. It should bother everybody. I mean, he's made promises. He's not fulfilling those promises at this point. And I think there has been, the market has been holding up, and people have been viewing basically some of these agenda promise items that he talked about in his campaign as kind of a call option on this market. Earnings have been good. We've had great top and bottom line growth here for second quarter reported earnings that is essentially now done at this point in time. And people have been basically kind of staying the course with the market at this point in time, as they have been saying, earnings are good. Maybe we're a little rich on valuation on the 17 numbers. If you roll out to 2018 numbers, you're probably more in line with the historical valuation metric that we've seen. But the call option is kind of losing its time value, shall we say, at this point in time. And I think that's the trouble spot for, I think, a lot of people in the market. And a lot of things haven't bothered the market. I mean, threats of nuclear war in North Korea. The market has only pulled back just slightly from its highs. So again, market's ignoring a lot of negative news and headlines, but the call option does appear to be fading a little bit, I think, in a lot of investors' minds. And that's why we're seeing a little bit of weakness in the tape right now.
And Craig, let's talk about, just say we get a miracle. They do cut. There seems to be more consensus with cutting corporate tax rates than there do individual rates. So let's just take a simple example. A company earns $100. The tax rate's 35%. They pay $35 out of the $100 in taxes. Let's say we get a corporate tax cut to 20%. So that's $15 more in profits. If you guys looked at, if we were to get something like that, what that would do to S&P earnings, and possibly, let's say, the value of the S&P itself, because, I mean, that is a big tax cut, and that puts a lot more dollars on the bottom line.
Yeah, you know, Jim, I think simplistically, the easiest way to think about it for the readers is this, that for every kind of 1% cut in that corporate tax rate is going to drop to the bottom line in terms of earnings. So the way I've been thinking about it this way is, if we're going to get a 5% cut, look for 5% pickup in overall corporate earnings. If we're getting 10%, think about it as a 10% upside. I think the numbers, as I've seen from CFRA, good friend Sam Stovall, who's been a friend of this program, I'm sure, over the years, you're looking for about $145, $147 in earnings Jim. So if we're to get a 10% tax cut at the corporate level, you're now looking at kind of, you know, the mid 155-ish type range. So if that is indeed the case, this market is definitely going to go higher, because that would put the valuation argument on this market to average, to slightly below average post-World War II. So again, that call option would be is something that a lot of people have been paying attention to. It's just that all of this noise in Washington and turnover and cabinet positions and councils and all these other things are leaving investors a little more nervous that perhaps Mr. Trump cannot get anything done in Washington. And that's why I think you've seen a little bit more volatility in the market as of late.
But given where we are, and we have this slight pullback, Craig, so far this year, we haven't even had a 5% pullback. Could this be one of those 5% pullbacks, or you see this as mild, or could it get and develop into something a little bit more serious if there's, let's say, disappointment in September, which tends to be a weak month, if Congress gets nothing done?
You know, at this point in time, I am still in the mindset that this is just a short-term noise. I don't think we're going to get a 5% pullback. In fact, we're finishing up some stuff for our August Informed Investor, which we will be publishing next week, where we go through a lot more of these kind of less than 5% type pullback years. And typically what you see is when you don't get a 5% pullback in the first half of the year, the market tends to be fairly strong through the remainder. In fact, in the book we published last month, Jim, what we had noticed is when you're up about 5 to 10% in the first half of any given year, you tend to see the second half also be fairly strong. In fact, when I go back and I just look at those statistics from the publication, what we have found is that you're typically up almost 7% in the second half on the S&P 500 when you're up 5 to 10 in the first half of the year, with a probability of about 83% for the full year and 78% for the second half of the year. So again, good statistics and good probabilities to say that at this point, we think it's just kind of a pullback and a dip, because I think a lot of the mindset for investors right now, Jim, is to really to be putting more cash back to work, as that they did not anticipate the market to be as strong as it is at this point. There were very few investors, or I should say strategists on Wall Street, that were looking for numbers at 24-24. In fact, we were an outlier, as you remember, Jim, at the beginning of the year. We've since raised that number on the S&P 500 to 25.75, and I think that's going to be a pretty good number. So, again, still more upside to go.
So if we, let's say we hit your number, 25.75, the Fed, let's talk about interest rates, because one thing the Fed is talking about doing, and they keep emphasizing it, I imagine will be brought up in Jackson Hole here shortly, is that they're going to be trimming back their balance sheet. So that means they're going to be withdrawing liquidity from the market, and they're still talking about another possible rate hike. Does that create a problem for you, Craig, as we go into 2018?
No, I don't think another rate hike is going to create a problem for kind of the bullish, perspective on this market. So the liquidity comes in a little bit. I think, you know, at the end of the day, we can go through many different kind of variations as to what the future is going to look like. But I think the one that I would keep squarely in mind is this, is the Fed is going to do nothing at this point in time to hurt this advance in the market. They may slow down. In fact, after the most recent meeting notes that came out, we saw the probability of a hike in December fall from the mid-40s into the 30s. And again, I think the street recognizes that they're going to do nothing to slow this market down and to cause a recession. So think of the Fed moving at a very gradual pace in terms of raising rates.
So as we look at that, let's talk about interest rates for a bit, because at the beginning of the year, most Wall Street forecasts were talking about 3%. If the Fed begins to shrink their balance sheet, do you think we will see higher interest rates as we head into December? Because right now on this Friday, interest rates are rather low. They're under 2.2%. Could we be higher towards the end of the year, or do you expect to remain low? Because we've been trading in a narrow trading range, but the trend has been definitely lower.
Trend over the last couple of weeks has definitely been lower, as we've been seeing nervousness about what's happening on the geopolitical front, especially in Washington. So we have seen some money flow out of equity ETFs and also equity funds. Where we have been at in terms of 10-year bond yields is we've been looking for rates to move higher, and a move above about 275 really is going to be a very important number to be watching in the marketplace for the bond market, in that that finally reverses a 31-year downtrend in rates. Jim, as you know, I've been looking for this trend reversal for quite some time. We are in print looking for a 3 to 3.25 10-year bond yield by year end. I think that may prove to be a little bit optimistic at this point in time, but I might be wrong in time, but I think I'll ultimately be correct in the next year or two that we do get that reversal to take place. And once we do, I think you're going to see rates start to work higher, and I think that is actually going to be a positive ultimately for equities. We're going to see money shift from fixed income, come back into equities, and I think that'll create a whole nother leg higher for this market.
I want to talk about something that we're seeing in equities that, Craig, we normally see towards the final phases of a bull market. The public is going back. Charles Schwab just reported they had a record amount of opening of stock accounts in the second quarter. In fact, this year, they would have to go back 17 years to the year 2000 to record as many stock opening accounts. The public is coming back in, and they're going into passive indexing funds, which, of course, as you know, is driving some of the valuations of some of these FANG stocks that have gotten very high valuations. Any comments on that? Does this mean anything, or is this an indicator of the final stage, or should we ignore that?
Well, I never like to ignore any data point. I always like to keep some of these data points, but in terms of weighting the probability and the meaning of it, I'd kind of put this toward the lower end of kind of the probabilities in my thinking. The reason being is that you've also seen a huge number of accounts get opened for things like Coinbase as people are becoming more interested in some of the cryptocurrencies and those things, Jim. But specifically, I think there is a trend of people wanting to perhaps step away from using more of a full-service advisor. They want to do some of these investing on their own, and they're going to places like Charles Schwab and Ameritrade and other places like that, and they're doing some of their investing themselves versus actually using a full-service advisor. That's their choice. I'm not sure it's necessarily the best move. Now, if I think we were at the end of this advance, I would think that a couple things would be happening. One, I would be seeing people like the shoeshine guy asking me about what stock should be bought. Not happening at this point in time. Second is I would think that neighbors, friends, and everybody else would be inviting me over for social parties to want to talk the market and other things. Still not happening. I'm seeing no evidence of that kind of froth in the market like we'd seen in 2000 or even in 2007 to a degree. So I think really what's happening is people are taking their finances on themselves to deal with this, and that's why you're seeing the growth in Charles Schwab, and they're saying, hey, if I'm just going to go put money into passive funds anyway, what do I need a full-service person to go put money into passive funds? They can use robo-advisors and other things to figure out their allocation. So I'd also just say, Jim, if this was kind of in the mania phase, I would think small, mid-cap, 4- or 5-digit symbol stocks would be really advancing, and that's where you'd be seeing a lot of excitement happening. That really hasn't been the case. It's still been more of the large cap names that have been pushing this tape higher, and I keep thinking about the early stages of what had happened in the early 1980s. It was large cap stocks that really started to lead initially as people were nervous about what had happened back in the 70s, and they came back into the equity market, but they did so using large cap stocks, and they were not the more speculative names.
All right, so let's move on to another area, and that has been commodities. Energy was one of the top performers last year as the price bottomed in February, and then we went from 26 to over 50. OPEC was planning cuts, so energy was a strong performer this year. Oil has weakened. Energy has performed terribly. But as you look at the commodity complex, there's a bifurcation in the commodities. Some of the ag stocks, especially, you know, the grains are doing very well. Copper has had a very good year, but oil, not so much. It has been weakening, but yet gold is up this year. So explain to me what you see in the commodity complex, because it seems like it's bifurcated.
Yeah, it definitely is. And when I kind of break this apart, you know, we've highlighted zinc lately along with copper. So what we're really seeing is the base metals, which would be used in more industrial situations, are doing quite strong. To me, that's a sign of stronger economic growth, whether it's in the U.S. or whether it's going to be in Europe or whether it's going to be over in Asia. But I think that definitely is a strong signal of better improving growth. Now, in terms of gold, gold still for me, I need to see a move above about 1300 in terms of the price of gold for me to come to any conclusion that we're getting any sort of trend change. Gold seems to be just kind of consolidating sideways, gets a little move up, gets a little move down. But again, I'm looking for that longer-term trend reversal. If we were to see that, Jim, that would signal to me more of a risk-off situation with investors. And that would then, I think, get a lot of investors to take an even more cautious stance toward the market. So that's a key level to be watching out there. In terms of some of the individual commodities, corns, the ags, and some of those, yeah, there's been some strength in those areas, and they seem to be showing some improvement. Now, in terms of overall crude oil, kind of an interesting and delicate balance between the supply side and demand side. The use of new technologies, horizontal drilling, other ways for us to get oil out of the ground in the United States, has led to a situation where production is up. We haven't seen any of these supply cuts that OPEC has talked about really have any teeth as of yet. But, you know, as we all know, those take some time to work through the system. I think it's very interesting that oil prices are where they're at now. These energy stocks have been pretty much down and out. I would just say that, and I've had this conversation with many managers lately, is that when the spread between your best and worst performing sectors in any given year, and right now it's energy being the worst, tech being the best, that differential is around 30%. Jim, for an entire year, I usually only see a 20 to 30% differential. So coming into the second half of the year, if one wants to take the out-of-consensus approach, and some managers are doing that, you trim a little tech and you buy some energy names in here because they're so out of favor. We have seen this happen in the past between energy and actually the healthcare sector a couple of years ago. Coming into the fourth quarter, you had about a 40% differential between the two. And back then, that was very extreme. And we saw the final quarter of the year with basically reversion of the mean happening between those two sectors. So I look for more of those activities between the energy patch and some of the best performing sectors, Jim.
You know, one thing that I find interesting on energy, if you take a look at the profits for some of these energy companies, I don't care if they're big companies like Royal Dutch or an Exxon or a Chevron, they've been spectacular. In fact, you know, I was recently reading that a lot of the increase in earnings in the S&P this year have come from the financial and energy sector, which have been two of the big underperformers.
That is absolutely correct. And I think a lot of investors shouldn't ignore that pickup in the profits. And like any business that has to go through a right-sizing, it seems like energy is going through that kind of right-sizing process. These are not companies that are going out of business or going away. They might be out of favor right now, but, you know, they're taking the right corrective actions. You're seeing the earnings begin to improve, and these stocks are starting to look more attractive for a lot of the value buyers.
Yeah, because the one thing that even though the drawdown has taken longer to balance the markets, the one trend, if you look at the charts and follow the weekly inventory levels, they've been steadily dropping, Craig. So sooner or later, you would think there would be some kind of balance. And if you look at a lot of these energy companies like the Exxons and Chevrons, they're moving into shale plays that don't take as much capital expenditures and they get faster paybacks, which is reflecting in some of the profit reports that we've seen in Q1 and Q2 coming out of many of these energy companies. So you've got one sector that has rising earnings and falling stock prices, which is creating this spread. And any time I've seen that in the past, Craig, that has usually spelt opportunity.
Absolutely. And when I look at some of the individual stock charts in the space, things like Chevron Texaco or the very lower end of the trading range, we've called out STO in our recent weekly piece, and we've also been calling out some of the refiners. So that's kind of the play right now, and the refiners would also be a play for an improving economy and an increased consumption in miles driven, too.
So if you were looking at what we're seeing right now as a short-term pullback, and Craig, I want to talk about the opportunities if you wanted to go into the sectors at a buying point. Let's say we get down to 2,400 as the support for the S&P 500. I've always asked this of technicians. What is it about August, September, first part of October that we always tend to see weakness in the market? It's almost like, you know, it's like the weather, you know, the change in seasons from fall to winter. Why does it always happen around this year? I've never had a good explanation why it occurs.
Well, I think it probably comes down to a couple things. One, you know, Europe is typically on vacation, so markets tend to be a little bit thinner. You also get a lot of managers here in the U.S. that tend to take holiday in the kind of August, September-ish time frame. So, you know, ahead of the Labor Day holidays. And so that leads to, again, thinner markets and fewer people in. So that's part of, I think, the explanation. And I think as you move into the fall, into September and October, to cover those time periods, I think that's when you start rolling out your estimates to think about 2018. So it's probably less of a technical viewpoint, Jim, than you were probably thinking about. But I think it's more about when do you decide you want to roll out to 2018 and what do those growth prospects ultimately look like. And I think that's why you see some more volatility in this period. Because I've asked many strategists and other people on the street, hey, don't call this market too expensive at this point in time, because if you roll out the 2018 numbers, you might start calling this market 5% cheap versus 7% expensive. So there's going to be a nice acceleration in the underlying earnings next year. And that's because of that time period, Jim, I think is why you're getting some of that volatility.
So given the fact that, you know, this is going to be a short-term correction and we're in the 2400 range, mid-range in the S&P on this Friday at 2431, where would you be going if you expect your year-end target at 2575? What would you expect to be the top performers as we head into the fourth quarter? Do you expect to see the same trend in the sectors that have done well this year, like technology, healthcare, some of the industrial stocks, or do you anticipate a change in, let's say, sector leadership?
No, I think you're going to see the leadership continue to reassert itself. And I would say that the FANG stocks, which have been the leadership of this market, will probably continue to be the leadership of this market. So the Facebook, the Amazon, the Apples, you know, the Netflix, the Googles, they will continue to be the leadership here. I think there will probably also be some of that profit-taking, Jim, that has been occurring in FANG over the last week or two. And some of that money is going to get put up into the most beaten-up area of the market, energy. And I think that will also prove to be a little bit of a driver in the second half, too. I'm not sure it's going to be enough of a driver to make energy a leading outperformer in the second half. I still think it's going to be technology. I still think probably the basic materials will be strong, too, given what we're seeing with some of these commodity charts. I'm starting to see select opportunities in consumer land. Some of the clothing manufacturers like PVH and G3 and some of those stocks look pretty good. And the experience areas of the market also, like cruise lines and hotels and casinos, still look strong from my vantage point. What I think will probably end up being weak, I think if we're going to move into the year, I think you're going to have to see rates work their way up. So I would think the interest-sensitive parts of this market probably do not fare as well.
So, final question, Craig. You know, you're holding to your target of 2575, which would imply a nice run-up into the end of the year. If there was something that would concern you, in other words, you know, you've been one of the most bullish forecasters out there that I've seen in this bull market, even at times when everybody, like in the early years of this market, when people were throwing in the towel, like 2011 or 2015, there were worries. If you were to have some concerns that would cause you to change your opinion, what would those concerns be?
Well, a couple of the concerns for me would be, number one, just keeping it to the charts, I would say, if we start seeing 10-year bond yields moving below 2%, that would be concerning to me. I think there's a lot of people that have said, hey, we're going to own the financial sector as long as we're going to remain above a 2% 10-year bond yield. Break below that, you're probably going to see some of these names in the financials get sold. If that was to occur, that would be a pretty negative trend to unfold for me. It would also bring back memories of 2007 to a degree, too, because we saw the divergence of the market in the financial sector. That historically has never been a good sign. The second concern for me would be if we can't get things kind of somewhat working. Right now, they don't look like they're working in Washington at all at this point in time. So if Trump can just simply stop texting and focus on what needs to get done for the country, I think at that point in time, we could probably see some strength in the dollar. But if the dollar keeps breaking down in here and we continue to see weakness in the dollar, I think that's going to also spell trouble for equities in the second half, too. So it's kind of those things. And if I could have one wish, Jim, I would love to just have somebody take the Twitter account away from Donald Trump and simply let's get back to work and let's do great things for the country.
Well, on the Friday, you and I are talking. It looks like another one of his advisors, Bannon, has been removed. And it just seems to be no end of dysfunction in the White House and in Congress. So let's keep our fingers crossed these guys can pull it together. Craig, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they can do so.
They are welcome to follow us. They can go out to the Piper Jaffray website, and you can find some of our research there. They could also email me if they're interested at craig.w.johnson@pjc.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining us from International Living is Jennifer Stevens. She's executive editor. And Jennifer, you follow not only some of the best places to retire around the globe, but also some of the best countries. And I wonder if we might start with, you have like a top 10 list of some of the best countries to live in for retirement, because I think as we go through those and get down to number one, one country has been there consistently, and I think it's going to surprise a lot of our listeners.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. You know, I should maybe start by just saying that there has never been an easier time to retire overseas, to go abroad. You have so many options today for moving full-time, but also moving part-time, for having investments overseas in countries where the values are good. And it's never been easier. It's never been easier to find information. It's never been easier to stay connected when you go overseas. You know, 27-some years ago when we started writing about this idea, it was kind of nutty. You know, if you went overseas, you kind of went, and maybe you wrote letters back home. But today, you can sit on a beach in a place like Belize, put your toes in the sand, and Skype your grandkids back home in Oklahoma. You know, and so a world is full of opportunities today that just didn't exist even 10 years ago, but certainly not 20 and 30 years ago. And so what we've done is kind of surveyed the world. We have folks who write for us, who are expats, who live all around the world, and we have gotten together with all of them and asked them questions so that we could come together and figure out the best places. And so our list includes places all around the world. And as you said, our number one pick for 2017 might surprise people. It is Mexico. I think there are some misperceptions about Mexico out there, but we hope to allay them with our coverage.
Well, gold prices this Friday are heading back up towards 1300. Are we finally going to break through that 1300 level? And if we do, what will be the catalyst and what will that mean for investors? Joining us from U.S. Global is Frank Holmes. Frank, let's talk about gold. It's been in an uptrend since the beginning of the year, but it seems to have difficulty crossing over that 1300 barrier. We've been up there almost three times this year. We're trying to make it back up there again. If we bust through 1300, what's going to cause it?
Well, I think it's right now, it's the geopolitical fears that are driving them. It's not North Korea. It's the tragedies in Barcelona and in Finland, and just creates a sort of fear. But in particular, it's North Korea. And the funny part about it is that the dollar is down two standard deviations. And mathematically, anytime it's down over 60 trading days, two standard deviations, we're due for a rally. And when you look at negative interest rates, you're seeing now that the 10-year and the 5-year government bonds have positive real rates of return. And historically, when you get those turning positive, the 2-year is still negative. And that is, whatever the government's trying to entice you to buy their government bonds, you take away the monthly CPI number. And whenever that number is positive, then gold usually sells off and the dollar rallies. But we're not having that now. So it's a really interesting time when you look at the fear, and the financial fear, I like to call it. But right now, I think it's more geopolitics. And also remember that we're in that second half of the year when we have the love trade taking place in Chindia. China and India, affectionately known as 40% of the world's population, buy gold for season festivities and birthdays and anniversaries, etc.
So, Frank, we have geopolitical fears. Of course, North Korea has kind of faded a little bit in the background with the terrorist attacks in Barcelona yesterday. You know, I can't remember a period of time Well, we've had so many geopolitical tensions occurring all at once. It's, you know, it's like every other month and sometimes months consecutively, we've had terrorist attacks in Europe. And now we've also had a lot of eruption coming out of North Korea with some very serious threats coming from our end. So is this enough to drive gold higher?
I think so. I think when we take a look at the continuous demand taking place out of China and India, and India picked up from last year, that demand, and we're having peak supply. There's no doubt there's no fracking technology that is impacting supply of gold like it did for the oil industry. There's no technological breakthrough. There's been no significant discoveries, and we're seeing, when we take a look at our models of looking at production per share, we're noticing, you know, the majors are all selling off, and overall, aggregately, it's peaked. So restrict supply and have that modest demand, and you get higher prices.
You know, as we have seen gold climb higher since the beginning of the year, we're seeing a series of higher lows, and with the exception of topping out around 1,300, let's talk about gold stocks because they have not done as well. I mean, there have been a few exceptions, but we had a nice run up from the beginning of the year all the way up into February, but it's been basically going sideways ever since.
Well, I think the real pain took place with this GDXJ phenomena, that they captured the GDXJ 95% of all fund flows. So rather than going to 10 different active fund managers, everyone wants to trade the ETF, and they piled in, and all of a sudden this one fund, which brought in $5 billion, is showing up. They're owning 20% or more of companies in Canada and other places, and so therefore they run into regulatory headaches to make a follow-up takeover offer, and immediately they have to unwind that trade. And they blew out last quarter $3 billion in 6 weeks of junior mining. And this had a big dent in North America and Australian gold stocks. So I think that the worst is behind us, but there's some really quality names like Klondex, et cetera, which we saw go from almost 8 to 4 and change when they still had the free cash flow of $10 million and increased their production per share. So I think the GDX and GDXJ model of just buying gold stocks for the sake of their market cap and production is flawed.
So as we look at some of these models, and I know in the past you've sort of favored the royalty companies because there's less risk involved, and those royalty companies seem to be the only sector that has performed strongly and consistently over the last couple of years. You still believe that to be the case?
Absolutely. And you know what's interesting is that we launched our own gold equity ETF called Go Gold, Go AU, that's on New York Stock Exchange. And it's very focused on values per share, whereas the other gold equity index that are out there, they're just about names and market cap. And we've seen and witnessed lots of value destruction on a per share basis. And so we've been, based on our regressional studies going back 10 years, the index that's populated, it's on Bloomberg, it's outperformed the GDXJ 94% of the time on rolling 12-month periods. And I'm asked, like, how could you do that? Well, there's a couple of reasons. And one is 30% are royalty companies, and they have a superior business model. They have lower volatility of cash flow. They have higher revenue per employee, higher revenue growth per share, and they have less destruction to their price-to-book value. And really what's happening in the capital markets is that quant funds are 60% of all trading, and they're looking at different factors than what the normal gold analysts used to look for. And they're looking for factors such as the book value change on a rolling quarterly basis, year-over-year basis. They're looking for momentum. They don't buy cheap book value. Usually that's a precursor to big write-downs. They're looking for momentum. And this shows up predominantly with the royalty companies. And then we applied other factors to it, and we consolidate portfolio to having only 28 names. It just outperforms the GDXJ on a consistent basis for investors.
So as we look at the commodity sector, we've had gold do well this year, the precious metal versus the stocks. Frank, we also have in the commodity sector, we've had the ags do very well. And then we also have had strong performance in copper. But the one lagging factor in this whole rise has really been the energy sector. So what does rising base metals tell you about the rest of the sector and the possibility for gold?
Well, I think it's more of a infrastructure get pushed through, and Trump is doing everything to make sure it gets done in America as well as in other countries, by particular going after EPA. There's holding them accountable, and it brings the Justice Department to go after the sort of religious environmentalists that occupy within the EPA. And because if they're going to push through a lot of infrastructure spending, it just won't get done if you have people that have tremendous political power and bureaucratic power can stifle the push through on infrastructure spending. And I think, guess the wisdom of crowds would say, a wonderful book written years ago by John Sarwecki, that there's something's happening that's positive with those other metal prices. And the other one is zinc. Zinc looks like it's making a 10-year breakout here, and it's looking very positive and constructive. And there's also supply restrictions. You're not seeing big supply come on stream. And any type of supply disruption for copper or for zinc really leads to higher prices.
So there's a couple things that we've seen. You know, China's economy has picked up, and of course there's demand there. And there's also anticipation, Frank, that eventually the U.S. does something on infrastructure, although the way things are dysfunctioning in Washington, one has to question if they can't get anything done, will that happen here? Any other drivers that you see in the commodity space? And let's talk about energy for the moment, because we've seen a series of inventories. The trend has been definitely down, but oil still remains weak. What do you think accounts for that?
I think fracking is accounts for that, because any type of rise, immediately they can turn on the spigot. And you're seeing other production coming on stream from the Middle East countries. And I also believe that most of these OPEC countries are all basically lie. And it's just that reality. And I think it's helpful for the global economy. And it's helpful for the airlines industry. Like we've talked before on the jets ETF, it's very beneficial to keep those energy prices down. What people don't realize is that we used to always have a huge surge this time of year with hurricane season threats and all the big rigs offshore and billion-dollar capex, et cetera. Well, that doesn't impact onshore drilling. And the fact that they've been able to get their costs down from $10 million to $9 million to $8 million to $7 million, $6 million, and some are pushing $5 million to drill these horizontal wells and fracking them, they're very efficient. So I think that this is a key component in the world. And then you have the disruption, even with Venezuela imploding, that you would think that would be positive for oil prices. But it's not been.
So given that, do you expect energy prices to remain weak? In other words, are we going to be looking at a bifurcated commodity market where you might see things like copper or gold do well, and maybe the ag sector, which is doing is having the grains are having a great year, but things like energy does not?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think gas is probably a better bet than oil. I think that oil is going to trade between 40 and 60. If it starts running to $60, you're going to have an acceleration taking place for fracking. So under $50, they just slow back and slow down. And I noticed last week when I was driving to the office in San Antonio, a train, a massive long train, nothing but sand. So that's going down for the frackers.
So it doesn't look like you're expecting anything in improvement in energy, but you do expect gold to break out given what we're seeing right now, the fact that the dollar is weak. Also, you have real strong interest rates. Do we finally break 1300? And aren't we entering in, Frank, typically as you head into the fall, you have the Indian wedding season. You also have gold buying ahead of Christmas. They're generally stronger periods of the time for the gold market.
You know, what's really shocked me is that, as I said earlier, about the dollar being down so much, you know, the mathematically we're due for a dollar to rally. And that would be a headwind to gold prices hanging above $1,300. So I'm not, you know, rip-roaring. I would love to see the dollar correct. And what I mean by correction is rebound. Price of gold come off, and then I think it takes off to $1,400, maybe $1,500. But from here, looking at statistical models going back two decades, it's very hard when the dollar's already down two standard deviations over 60 trading days, 1.5 standard deviations over 12 months, to mount a massive sustainable rally. Now, a correction, 3 to 5%, then we can go.
So if you were to take out your crystal ball, and Frank, let's say you and I were having a conversation or a cup of coffee December 31st, would you expect gold prices higher from where they are now?
I think they're going to be higher because there's still not the will by the G20 countries to streamline regulations. They're still on steroids. They used to meet prior to 2008 for synchronized global trade, and now it's synchronized taxation and regulation. We've not seen anything in the financial sector slow down AML anti-money laundering laws become more and more difficult, more expensive, more punitive. We've seen where Bermuda, we've had investments, we've been a sub-advisor, like sending money back to us. Oh, no, we can't send it back to the U.S. They won't have you. If you bought a property in Bermuda, they're going to shut down your bank account. They just will not have any American taxpayers. They would not want an account because the burden of the AML. I hear this story all over the world. So you're creating a friction of fund flows, of investments, and tagging on that it's just it's to go after drug dealers, which is good, and after ISIS members and contributors, good. But that is a small piece of the overall world's economic activity, and it's slowing down the flow of funds. And there's other sets of regulations, like this, the interpretation of the fiduciary rule got pushed down out, but that whole interpretation, all this stuff creates friction to the flow of capital, to the creation of jobs. And so the only way the government can maintain what it's doing is to have asset inflation. So we take a look in Toronto, real estate prices are just, in decades, are up like 300%. But incomes aren't up 300%. So how does someone buy a home? And you take a look at new jobs being created in the space, they're still not comparable to be able to afford these new homes. So I think that we're seeing a distortion where inflation is showing up in assets with cheap, cheap money. And I think that unless they can streamline regulations to ignite sustainable growth, then we're going to have to live with negative real interest rates. And that's only bullish for gold. And the more negative interest rates are, the higher the price of gold will go in any country's currency. So when gold hit 1900 in America in 2011, when you take a look at that data point, the 10-year government bond was minus 300 basis points. That means you're going to buy a 10-year government bond and lock in a 3% loss on your money every year. So I think that this is the reality. Trump seems to be taking on what they call the Beltway Party, which are all the bureaucrats and all the lobbyists have come together. And I was at a conference where Bernanke spoke, and that was most interesting when he compared Donald Trump to Jimmy Carter. And he said both took on the Beltway Party, and the Beltway Party all of a sudden takes on whoever the president is going to affect their jurisdiction. So I think that we're going to live with negative interest rates unless there's really a sea change in this regulatory, global regulatory slowdown.
So, summing up here, as we head into the fall, you would expect higher gold prices. And this time, do you expect, Frank, that the gold prices will be supported by not only higher silver prices, but also the gold stock equities?
Yeah, I think that the equities, in particular, is to look at the companies that really protect the value per share. And if you want to play it safe, you buy the three royalty companies, you rebalance them every quarter and or once a year, and I think that's the safest way. Or you go and look at the products like GoAU, which is doing that for you, and it's a superior way of looking at gold stocks, and those gold stocks will outperform. I mean, I give you a classic example, is if you just took the 10 best gold stocks on revenue per share growth, and you rebalance every quarter, last year, when the GDX was up 52%, those 10 names are up 127%. Year-to-date, they are double. So there are factors that are this, the idea of reserves per share, production per share, revenue per share, cash flow per share is so important. And so the labor in this point is that in the past 4 years, the constituents of the GDXJ have diluted the investors' upside by issuing shares at 110%. That is almost a 25% a year increase the number of shares, but the price of gold hasn't gone up 25% a year, and their production hasn't gone up 25% a year, so therefore there's been value destruction. And by focusing on those companies that protect those values per share, they far outperform, and yes, those gold stocks will rip it up for investors.
Well, listen, Frank, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you guys do at U.S. Global, tell them how they could do so.
Well, they go to usfunds.com, and you can subscribe to Frank Talk and Investor Alert. We publish every Friday Investor Alert, which is a game film analysis of different asset classes in addition to gold and tax-free space. It looks at emerging markets from Asia to Eastern Europe and big cap stocks and growth stocks in America. And it's always concise and comprehensive. And so I go to usfunds.com. And if you're interested in ETFs world that we've launched our two products, you go to goAUETF.com and you get more research in that category. And you go to JetsETF.com for more research in the airline industry.
Well, it's very obvious that we are headed towards a recession, probably sometime in 2018, 2019. But my question now is, since we know that the Fed has been behind all recessions and bear markets with a rate-raising cycle, if there is a storm coming, what are the details of the storm? There are several trouble spots: auto loans, student loans, and corporate debt. But now that you know that, between now and the time the storm comes, what can you do in investments? What can you do to prepare for the storm? And what will it look like on the lee side of the storm when it passes? All of that will be discussed on The Big Picture coming up next, right here on the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.